And you're on the front porch where we tackle the tough issues facing West Virginia and Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. This week, we're talking with Garrett Ballingy. He's the executive director of the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy. Hey, Garrett.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, no problem. And he's here because the Cardinal Institute is sponsoring this big intellectual shindig here in Charleston on Thursday. And what are you guys calling it?
West Virginia on the Rise, rebuilding the economy and rebuilding lives.
All right, we're going to talk about the issues of that conference. We're going to preview it. The opioid epidemic, rebuilding our state's economy, strengthening families, all sorts of good stuff. The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts. Download it at iTunes or Google Play. I'm Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. We're joined, as always, by lawyer and conservative columnist Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And Rick Wilson, our liberal columnist who works for the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
All right, let's get to it. Garrett, what is this event? Why is it happening?
We're co-sponsoring this with the American Conservative Union Foundation. Some of your listeners might be familiar with CPAC, which they put on every year. It's the largest annual conservative gathering in the country. And so they approached us wanting to highlight and discuss some of the major problems and issues facing West Virginia. West Virginia is a pretty popular topic. We thought it was important to talk about West Virginia's economy, the opioid epidemic, and the role that the family sort of plays in both of those. And so it's going to be from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, September 21st. We've got a really good lineup of speakers and panelists, and hopefully we can advance some pretty novel solutions to these really tough problems.
Who do you have coming?
So the headliner will be Jeff Sessions. He'll be our first speaker.
The Attorney General.
U.S. Attorney General, that's correct, to open up the event. Alex Mooney is going to give a talk. Patrick Morrissey is going to give a talk. We have Thomas Honig coming in, who is the vice chairman of the FDIC and former head of the Kansas City Federal Reserve. Policy wonks and rock stars from the Heritage Foundation and American Conservative Union.
And just a disclosure here, but also in case you're wanting to see this and you can't make it yourself, we're planning to live stream this on the West Virginia channel and also on the internet at wvpublic.org. I'm sure it's going to be on the Cardinal Institute's website as well.
Yes, check out cardinalinstitute.com, also on our Facebook page. So if you want to watch or listen and you're not able to attend in person, then by all means, catch the live stream.
I hear that there might be some protests expected at this thing, especially with Jeff Sessions coming.
Yes, yeah, so we are aware of that. We understand there's going to be a protest organized for across the street at Haddad Riverfront Park. There's nothing more American than a protest. And so, frankly, if we weren't getting protested, if it was just sort of another event that was happening in Charleston, that would be a disappointment. What we don't want to have happen, though, is sort of this trend that we've seen here in the last probably year or so, where people try to shout other people down, or you try to get into the place and disrupt it so a discussion and a dialogue can't actually occur. You know, we don't want to have that happen, and we're taking means to make sure that doesn't. But if it's just a good old-fashioned protest, then absolutely, we support that 100%. But we don't endorse or support the idea of shouting other people down simply because they hold different views.
That was just the sort of bedrock value that Americans had on, you know, all different sides of issues.
Yeah, what's really new and alarming to me is the whole idea that what someone says can actually threaten your safety. We hear so much talk about this, especially on college campuses. Let's have a safe space. And what they mean, it has nothing to do with physical safety. It means I don't want to hear something that I disagree with, that makes me feel uncomfortable, that challenges me. And it's that conflation of, you know, safety. And the reason that folks reach for those words is because, you know, what's less controversial than wanting to stay safe, right? And all parents want their kids to be safe. Everyone wants to be safe. And so if you can couch something in terms of this threatens my safety, well, that sounds really bad. That sounds like we should stop it. But we're just talking about people talking.
There's a related but countervailing trend too. I saw this study about in the last year, there's been these huge changes in what people think is acceptable dialogue in the public sphere, correlated with the rise of Donald Trump. People all of a sudden now expect harsher, coarser, more attacking sort of language, and that they think that that's the norm more than they used to in the past. And so you have this sort of weird dichotomy where some people are trying to shut down speech, and then meanwhile, there's been this coarsening of the public dialogue.
Well, in addition to that, you have people driving cars through crowds of protesters, and the new normal apparently is having armed groups show up at public events, which has already happened here a couple of times in West Virginia.
It has?
Yeah.
You've seen it? Like when you go to these things?
Yeah.
What happens with the armed? I'm just curious. The armed groups, are they in the background?
Unfortunately, they've been pretty laid back so far. We'll say that. But yeah.
Huh. So this is the context in which you guys are trying to have this intellectual panel discussion. Why now? Why do you think it's important that the Cardinal Institute is trying to do these things now?
Well, we have to talk about these solutions. I mean, West Virginia, and I think we've talked about this before, but we really are at a turning point for our state. We're seeing young people leave in numbers that they've really never left before. The opioid epidemic, the suicide rates, all these things are increasing. And so we thought it was good to not only have a discussion, but frankly, to bring in other people that have experiences at the federal level and in other states to see how have you guys dealt with this? Because I think West Virginians like to think they're sometimes alone or their problems are somehow unique, but they're really not. We have somebody that lives in Maine. Maine is facing extremely similar problems to what West Virginia is as far as brain drain and heroin overdose rates and things like that. And also, frankly, if you go to an event in West Virginia that discusses anything like this or maybe even related to it, there's probably a group of 50 or 100 people that are likely going to speak on it. That's just the way it is here. And so bringing in a fresh perspective, I think, will maybe advance some novel solutions that we frankly haven't heard before because we're in a bit of an echo chamber here in West Virginia.
Well, and there's a lot of frustration with Washington, you know, and not just the last few months, but the last few years, not really being able to get anything done, maybe more interested in scoring political points than actually moving policy forward. What hope do you have that we can move the ball forward?
Well, I think you have to be hopeful because if not, that leads to a lot of other bad things. I think it's important for the left and the right to recognize, despite what your wishes are, the other side's not going away. And so you have a couple choices. You can either continue down this path where you view the other side as evil or you try to dehumanize them, and then that allows you to feel like you're self-righteous in some way if you attack them or you run into them with a car or something like that. Or you can sit down and you can address issues in a civil type of way. You can understand that both of you largely have the same ends. The question is, are the means? And so if you can talk to people in that sort of way, you will discover ideas that perhaps you didn't think of, that you didn't bring to the table before you sat down with people.
All right. Well, speaking of, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the conservative prescriptions for what ails West Virginia. But first, I'm going to do something completely different and very self-serving. I hope you'll forgive me. People have been raising questions about the fact that we changed our TV programming. We had these comedies from the BBC on Saturday mornings. They were from the 70s and 80s.
Is this like Are You Being Served?
Yeah, Are You Being
that,
Served.
That is an awesome one. I'm sad to leave. Even though I never
really
watched it on West Virginia, that is so good. It's
at
so
two,
funny.
Lori.
I'm sorry. I'll stop now.
It's okay. We've stopped airing it. And the reason we've been giving people is we've had a state budget cut. We have to be more efficient. But the other thing that's going on that I really want to talk about is there's been this streaming revolution, streaming of video. How many people in here stream on Netflix, Hulu, Amazon? Rick, do you do that?
Yeah, when our router's working.
And you have that?
Yeah, Netflix and Amazon.
How about you, Garrett?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, because Gary
is, he's a millennial. that's pretty much all
group,
he does,
right?
He just like, sits at home at night and streams video.
Is there something
video
else than streaming?
Right. Yeah, what is this cable you speak of?
Do you have cable, honestly?
I do, yes.
Okay, so he has cable and streaming.
Yes.
Even I have partially cut the cord. All I get is like the basic cable package with PBS, of course, on there. And then, you know, we stream everything else. And because of that, what the BBC is doing is they're like, well, we don't really want to distribute our programming through PBS stations anymore. And they're pulling back on what they're offering. And they're putting it in these packages where you have to pay a subscription fee to, and you can watch some of these old programs. And so our future, we think, is original programming about West Virginia. That's what we're really focusing on. And so I'm sorry if you're one of the people that depended on us in this way. There are good reasons why we had to do it, and we appreciate your patience. You know, at the end of the day, public service to me is the more important thing, and the public service things we do include providing educational programs to kids that they can't get anywhere else, especially low-income kids, and telling West Virginia's story, which is what no one else is going to do. And if you have any questions, email me at sfin@wvpublic.org, and definitely do not go to the reader's vent at the Charleston Gazette Mail.
But what about Sherlock?
Sherlock's fine.
So that wasn't part of the package?
No, that's fine.
Okay, you're good then.
All right, and thanks. Okay, we're back, and we're talking about conservative prescriptions for what ails West Virginia. At this conference that's coming up this West Virginia on the Rise, Rebuilding the Economy, Rebuilding Lives. There's going to be focus on opioids, economic development, family issues. Of the three, what do you want to talk about first?
I think maybe the most controversial, at least whenever we try to reach out to the more, maybe our more progressive friends, is the role of the family. That'll be the third panel. We'll have Scott Moody will be a panelist. Scott's a pretty well-known former policy analyst for the Heritage Foundation. He and his wife, Wendy, created an index called the Family Prosperity Index that attempts to measure the health of the family, how that interplays with the health of an economy in a state. What is the role of the family in combating the opioid epidemic and drug addiction and things like that? So I'm personally very interested to talk about the role of the family. I know a lot of times conservatives tend to kind of reflexively stay away from that whenever they talk to other folks, maybe outside their political persuasion. West Virginia's got some pretty terrifying statistics if you believe that the family plays an important role in creating a civil society and creating a healthy economy. West Virginia, I think in 2015, only 62% of kids were in households where the parents were married. That's from 72 or 73% in 2000.
Wow.
The literature is very clear that if you don't grow up in a household with two parents, the likelihood that you get yourself in very bad situations or make bad decisions is extremely high. And I think West Virginia, that's something that we need to focus on. The problem is, from a policy perspective, it's unclear what role we can play in mitigating some of that. I don't think you necessarily want to make it harder to get a divorce, for example. And so it'll be interesting to see how that dialogue progresses over the course of the event with somebody like Scott. So I'm really interested to see what kind of solutions they come up with there.
I mean, it would seem like that wouldn't be the kind of thing you could legislate. I'm also wondering how family is defined and what their positions are, what forces they think are destroying the family. I'd be curious to hear about that.
But I do think there's a lot of literature that talks about the need for having, you know, a two-parent household. It just makes sense. You need backup. It's not like you can't make it work as a single parent, but there are a lot of – it's just a lot harder. And I think in West Virginia, we had this idea that we're different, that we have strong families in West Virginia. But it sounds like the data says we're not any different than the rest of the country.
No, so if you take it as a percentage, as I mentioned, of children in married households, we're 39th. So about 62.8%, but we're also the lowest regionally. So Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania all have children that are in households with a higher percentage of married couples.
39th in the country, which is bad.
That's right, yeah. So you want to be first. I think Utah is about 84% on the high end. Mississippi is on the low end at 55%. And then West Virginia is 39th, about 62, 63%.
I mean, one thing, when I think about family life, I think that the economic base of a secure family life has been severely undermined. We've had major deindustrialization. We've had major cuts to programs that help make families sustainable. I think our policies often make it harder for people actually to earn a living. So that's one part that I would see going on here.
I mean, maybe it's overdetermined. If you have poor prospects for your future, you're not as likely to be marriageable. And then you might decide opioids are an option for you for your life because you lose hope. And then once you start on that path, you can't get back and get into work because now you're addicted. It's like, I think these things all kind of play on each other and build on each other in really nasty ways.
Plus, if you're engaging in mass incarceration of people, you're making sort of sustainable family life out of reach for a lot of people as well, not to circle back to Jeff Sessions or anything.
Well, let's do a little kumbaya moment here between you and I think the folks at the ACU, right? Because there's been some left and right agreement among some circles about the need for a different type of criminal justice reform.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one sort of shining area between disparate groups, everything from the ACLU to the ACU on the right. I know Charles and David Koch have been behind reform, criminal justice reform, for a very long time as far as what's called banning the box, not allowing your company to ask felons if they're in certain jobs. Like, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Can I ask about that one? I mean, if we had House Speaker Tim Armstead in here, he would say, as an employer, don't I have the right to know what your background is? I mean, why is banning the box this cause celeb? If I'm hiring people, I kind of want to know.
Well, banning the box doesn't prohibit employers from doing other kind of background things. It just eliminates people from being screened out right away. And actually, it's been done in a lot of really conservative places. I think Georgia recently did it and some other places. So that's one thing it doesn't eliminate that possibility. Also, West Virginia did pass a weakened version of the Second Chance for Employment Act last year. Actually, one of the sponsors of Band the Box in West Virginia has been Delegate Upson from the Eastern Panhandle, who's Republican.
So we had our kumbaya moment. Let's talk about the family again. Lori, this is something that you, I think, are really passionate about. What do you think that we could do in the public policy sphere to deal with these, you know, issues?
Well, that's really the question. I mean, I think Garrett alluded to it. It's very difficult to it's probably not a political problem. It's probably, in part, a cultural problem. And so you can't use the tool of policy solution, you know, from legislation, government, to attack what is fundamentally a cultural shift away from the importance of marriage. You know, having children out of wedlock used to be, throughout most layers of society, you know, a bad thing, something you wanted to avoid. And now that's kind of crept up to where, yeah, it's not really that big of a deal unless you're kind of the very elite. And we've talked about this before, about this class of people, often very liberal people, who live kind of like Puritans in a way, in terms of, you know, their marriage rates, their marriage, childbearing outside of marriage. But those same people seem really reluctant to say, you know, this is a really good way to live. Other people should live this way. We seem to kind of have, well, you know, I don't want to judge. And that's good in many ways, because you don't want a culture where women, for example, who get pregnant out of wedlock are shamed and, you know, forced outside of the norms of society. But at the same time, there are costs to it being just completely fine, right? There's more of it. And as we've seen, those kids statistically tend not to do as well. So it really is a conundrum.
I want to raise a question then. I'm sure there's an answer to this. If it's a cultural shift that's allowing the permissiveness that's leading to more working class people raising kids out of wedlock, if that's it, then why wouldn't it be affecting the upper middle class? If it's just a cultural shift, like, oh, this is okay, why would the classes differ in how they're reacting to that cultural shift?
Well, I think it has to some extent. But, you know, at the same time, I think you look at certain groups, like, for example, you're willing to transmit that value to your kids, for example. Like, you say to your kids, wait until you're out of college to get married, wait until you get married to have a child. But that you're not willing to kind of say that to society at large. It's something you're transmitting, you know, through your family, but yet it's not, you're willing to say it's not so much a social norm, I think.
I get it.
But it doesn't always work when you say it within the family either, with the record state, right? The other thing I do think, really, in the context of growing inequality with things like higher education and stuff, you could go on and on about the things that are making it harder and harder to get a stable base to build a life on. So I don't think it's all cultural at all.
Well, yeah, it doesn't have to be, does it?
No one is saying that it's all cultural, but I mean, I certainly don't think you can say it's all economic either. I mean, people throughout history have had hard economic times, right? I mean, there were people living in dugouts and traveling across the country in stagecoaches that settled the country. They thought marriage was really important. So, you have to, it's two sides of the same coin. Well, you can't just say it's one or the other.
They build on each other, right?
That was an economic unit of the family, too, if you're a subsistence farmer or something.
Sure, but it was very difficult. They had very difficult lives, and yet they still managed to be married. I mean, the point is, like, you can be economically stressed and stressed in many, many other ways and still stay married to one person and have kids, you know, within that marriage and transmit that value to your kids. It's not just, oh, you know, I don't have a job, well, I can't be married.
Well, I think, similar to what we were talking to earlier, it's sad that often middle to upper middle class people, they live in certain ways, but they're not willing to engage in the larger dialogue and debate about this. And the question is, why? Like, why would these people feel uncomfortable to come out and say, well, you know what, it probably is a good idea to get married and to get your college education first before you have kids? So I think that's something that we maybe should try to address at this panel next week, is why is it so dangerous? Why are people so reluctant to go out and say these types of things in the broader community?
I think the other question to that is it effective? I mean, if I sit here all day long and say, bad, bad white working class single mother or whatever, is that really going to change anything?
But I think it does. I think cultural mores play a very important part. I think, for example, I don't have the statistics on this, but my guess is that spanking as a form of punishment for children has gone down precipitously in the last 20 years. Have we passed laws about that? No, of course, we've always had child abuse laws, but I think that's been an element of cultural shaming, to use that word. And I do think doing something like that is effective to an extent.
Yeah, it goes back to the issue of, and it's really tough. It's like you don't want to make an individual who finds themselves in this single mother situation, or for that matter, I mean, single father situation. I mean, you don't want to necessarily make them feel like they're bad for what they've done. They don't, especially don't want the kid to feel like they're, you know, bastards. That was what we said in the past. So you have that issue. But at the same time, how do you say, well, in this instance, we want to support the single mother who's raising the kid on her own, but in the broader sense, this is a bad trend. It's hard to thread that needle.
It doesn't even have to be shaming, too. That's an important thing to say. They've done a study, a really interesting study, that shows that where the MTV show about, Garrett, you probably know the name of this, the MTV show about being teenager and pregnant, where that show is popular, just being exposed to that show drops the teen pregnancy rate. And the reason is because the show depicts how not glamorous it is to have a little baby and to be a teenager. And so, I mean, you can't look at that and say that people don't look at what's going on around them. So just even a message like that can have an effect on something like the teen pregnancy rate.
I just kind of want to throw this out there to brainstorm a little bit. Do you guys feel like that part of this is because the lines of cultural transmission are sort of breaking down? So like in the 50s and 60s, it was not uncommon to have the factory CEO and general manager and foreman living on the same street with the janitor and the assembly line worker, going to the same churches and all that sorts of things. And so you're able to sort of show an example by doing, not necessarily telling somebody, right? So, oh, okay, he's married. And I wonder if we've sort of clustered ourselves off like this now, like, you know, one of Charles Murray's main theses and some of his writing. And so I wonder now if we're simply left with telling people instead of actually showing and demonstrating, because we've kind of siphoned ourselves off from each other.
Yeah, and then on top of that, the other thesis about the hoarding of the dream, you know, I mean, maybe upper middle class families don't care that other families are not, you know, staying together because it benefits them in some way, or they perceive it benefits them.
Right. Their kids are going to have a better shot of getting into Princeton if everybody else's kids are getting pregnant at 17 or what. You know, I think there's something to that. I don't think it's conscious, certainly, mm-hmm. but I do think there is something to that theory.
People can be very liberal about their ideas until it affects their kids. It's not even them. It's their kids. And then you want every advantage for your kid. You don't care.
It works the other way, too. You can be really conservative about stuff until you want your industry bailed out or something. I'm just saying.
Or when you want your kid to have health insurance all of a sudden and they have some disease or whatever. Yeah. So this family stuff, yeah, that gets to the meat of it. And maybe that's the root of it all. Maybe the opioid crisis, maybe our economic troubles, maybe that's just all symptoms of the family issue.
What I'm wondering is, when you look at the opioid crisis, and I'm sure this will be talked about at the conference, but what is something you see not being done in the ideal way? I mean, what's a conservative criticism of the way that we are addressing the opioid crisis?
That's a really good question. I don't know if there's sort of a monolithic conservative answer to that, right? You'll have some folks that say, well, let's lock them up, throw away the key. Oftentimes, prison is a good way to get people off of drugs. I think the statistics probably maybe don't bear that out quite as much as some people think. I think sort of the new age, and I'll put that in air quotes for the listeners, conservative approach is to focus on rehab and to focus on integrating these people back into society to become productive members of society. And so that's why you're seeing groups like American Conservative Union, Institute for Justice, which is a very libertarian law firm, partnering with groups like NAACP and ACLU on the left to figure out, you know what, this approach is not working. We still have some old guard conservatives that maybe say, lock them up, throw away the key.
And Jeff Sessions is kind of one of those, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's certainly been a lightning rod for that sort of thing. And it's been nice and I think refreshing to see those of us that are also on the right, again, air quotes, to come out and say, you know what, maybe that's not the best approach. And here's why we think that's not the best approach, which I think is why it's so important for this event to happen. We have to have people talking with each other, which is why we're super thrilled to be partnering with WBPB on this to demonstrate, you know what, you might have different ideas about things, but that doesn't mean you have to shout each other down. It doesn't mean you have to shut each other down. Let's sit down, talk about it, and through that process, we'll find a better solution.
So one thing I think is sort of, a contradiction is some of the people who are going to be talking about this want to eliminate Medicaid expansion, which has made opioid addict treatment possible for many people. There's a lot of studies about places where that's been enacted. Kentucky. I've talked to several people in West Virginia who've received help through the ACA, through Medicaid expansion. They're saying without, if they lose that, you know, they might be in jail, they'd lose their kids, they don't know if they'd be alive. And so, like, there's a big degree of hypocrisy, I think, to say we're going to talk about fixing the opioid thing, and by the way, we want to yank the treatment carpet out from under these people. So
I'm not sure who the we is in that, but I will say a problem of this magnitude is going to require solutions coming from the public sector. It's going to require solutions from the private sector. It's going to require solutions from civil society. And so I think we have to look at each one of those and say, what role does the government play in this? What role does private society and businesses and the economy play? And what role do families and civil society play in fixing this issue?
So anything else that you guys want to add?
Rick, are you going to be processing?
I don't know. I'm supposed to be in Wheeling that day. I'll have to check my calendar.
So many places to protest. So little time.
So little time.
All right, then. Garrett, you get the last word here.
Again, the event is next Thursday, September 21st from 9:30 to 2 p.m. Please RSVP. You can go on Cardinal's Facebook page, American Conservative Union. It's up on their webpage as well. And looking forward to having a lot of people there. And if you do show up, please try to be civil and allow people to have a nice dialogue about these really tough problems.
Excellent. And just one last editor's note here from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm really excited to get these ideas out to a larger audience, and we want to have a diverse, you know, spectrum of ideas out to a larger audience as well. And so if you're listening to this and, you know, you're part of another type of group, you know, maybe if you're Ted Bettner, for example, who was here debating Garrett not too long ago on the front porch, we want to get those on the air too. We have this idea of trying to spread these ideas and to get beyond the sound bites and try to really dig into this. So give me a call or shoot me an email at sfin@wvpublic.org. Rick, what's your Bible verse for the week and or words of wisdom?
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy.
Okay. Any particular reason for that one? Nope.
Just let it ride.
I think we need to start a database of the Bible quotes he uses, because I'm starting to think that he might be recycling. So I think we need to kind of do like an Excel spreadsheet every week, and then we could say, no, sorry, you need to go to the next one. You've already used that one.
Have you heard of the 80-20 principle? It's like, you know, 80% of the stuff we do, you don't use. 20% is you get the most out of, and vice versa. So Yeah, that goes with about everything. Yeah.
And that's The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director and CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. We've been hearing from Garrett Ballingy. He's the Executive Director of the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy. Garrett, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and Lori Lynn, our conservative columnist and host. And thank you for listening.